I'm Charlie Ornstein, and I'm a senior reporter here at ProPublica, and I cover healthcare. Today, we're going to be talking about the opioid epidemic, a topic that's been in the news for some years now, but has really gained attention, particularly in the last year or so, as communities across the country are struggling with epidemics of overdoses and deaths and the consequences that it brings. Joining me today to talk about this is David Armstrong, who is a senior enterprise reporter at STAT, which is a promising new health and medicine website that you can find at statnews.com. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
The first thing I'm wondering is, it's not a surprise to anybody in this country, if you've been paying any attention to the media, that we're facing sort of an epidemic of opioid overdoses and that the problem seems to be getting worse over time. So what makes you as a reporter interested in covering a story that perhaps some people feel that they already know?
So the reason we thought it was important to cover the opioid crisis is really twofold. One, as you mentioned, STAT is a new publication, and we're focused on medicine, health, and science. And to my way of thinking, in terms of a public health issue, at this moment in this country, there's nothing more pressing than the opioid crisis. So from that standpoint, I felt it was important that we cover this and put our stake in the ground, if you will. The other thing that really troubled me about this and piqued my interest in doing more was the rise of fentanyl. You know, fentanyl is so potent and is really adding to the death toll in a way that we haven't seen. And I wanted to know more about that. I wanted to know what was going on. And part of that is knowing more about how we got here, in addition to what's going on now.
So let's just take a second and talk about fentanyl, because I'm not sure that everybody understands sort of the differences between the different substances. And so for a number of years, we were largely talking about narcotic painkillers, right? So Percocet, Vicodin, things you got from a prescription for your doctor, and that people were getting addicted on those, and those were leading to overdoses. Fentanyl is likewise, it can be a prescription drug, but tell us what you're talking about when you're referring to fentanyl.
Yeah, so fentanyl can be a prescription drug. It's primarily used, or at least intended for use, in late-stage cancer patients who can't get help from any other medication. In terms of its sales in the U.S., it's pretty limited compared to the other painkillers that you just mentioned. So what we're really talking about is the illicit sale of fentanyl in this country. And, you know, one of the things that makes it different is it's produced in a laboratory. So with heroin, you know, you have to grow it, you got to water it, you know, you have to harvest it. It's a completely different beast. Fentanyl, just a small amount produced in a lab, can be more potent than heroin. And for drug dealers and criminal syndicates, a lot easier to get into the country and a lot cheaper. So that's why we're seeing the emergence of this drug.
So is the emergence of fentanyl related to sort of efforts to crack down on prescription painkillers, and this is just another avenue by which the desire or the need for the drugs is manifesting itself?
That's part of it. In areas where we've seen restrictions on prescribers and very aggressive prescription monitoring programs, there's no question that some people who are abusing opioid painkillers or prescription painkillers, if you will, transition to heroin. But drug dealers and cartels are pretty smart, pretty cynical. And what they saw was a rise in the use of opioids. And they realized that they could initially produce heroin cheaper and supply that same population with a similar high, a similar drug at a lower cost. So those two things happened in parallel tracks, even though you did have people switching from one to the other. And now with fentanyl, we're just seeing more of the same, except it's just more profitable for drug dealers.
And I noted a story you wrote in August in which you said that these illegal street drugs and not prescriptions are powering the current state of the epidemic. And one of the things that's striking to me is that in certain towns across the country, including some you've written about, what you see is that over the course of a few hours, you'll have dozens of people overdosing, creating massive problems for those areas. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, and this is what's terrifying about what's happening now. The thing about fentanyl is the drug dealers are putting it in heroin and not telling the users that you have fentanyl in this heroin. And even more disturbing, they are selling fentanyl masqueraded as Xanax, as cocaine, as regular prescription painkillers. And they are tens of times more potent than those drugs. So what happens with these mass overdose outbreaks, and we've had some incredible ones this summer, 300 people in Cincinnati over a couple of weeks, 300 in Akron with multiple, two dozen fatalities. Last weekend in Cleveland, 7 deaths on Saturday, all from what is believed to be fentanyl-laced products. So they get into the marketplace, if you will, and some organization has spiked heroin, for instance, or misbranded Xanax or OxyContin or something else that's really fentanyl. People take it, they don't know what they're taking, and they're not prepared for it, the tolerance isn't there, and they overdose. And if it wasn't for Narcan, which is an antidote to these opioids, we would be talking another multiple of the incredible number of deaths we already have.
So you wrote a piece that was really compelling about two best friends from Ohio, actually, teenagers, DJ Shanks and Justin Laycock, and their relationship and their bonding over drugs. And I found it really compelling because, as you tell, DJ died in February of 2015. I don't think that's a secret. And what happened to Justin after that happened and his role in this. How did you get turned on to this story, and why did you decide that this was a story that needed to be written?
I'll answer the second question first. I felt like that story was a good way to talk about the issue I just raised, which is the vast majority, and this is somewhat anecdotal, admittedly, but you know, I'm talking to law enforcement and coroners and other people across the country, the vast majority of fatal fentanyl cases tend to be people that didn't know they were taking it, and that's why they died. So I thought this was a way to sort of tell that story. DJ and Justin, best friends since kindergarten, grew up to have an addiction problem together, but they were heroin users, and it also started with prescription painkillers. They were using Vicodin, and they accidentally used heroin laced with fentanyl. Justin brought the drug to DJ, who was working at a Tim Hortons donut shop at the time, and he snorted it, and he died on the job. And what really, one of the more compelling aspects, I think, of that story is what happens to Justin. You know, he wasn't his drug dealer. He was helping out a friend, he thought, because DJ told him he was dope sick and needed something, so he brought it to him, didn't charge him, he paid for it, and he was arrested. And he was charged with a crime, a drug charge crime. But that was a mandatory prison sentence. And the thing that really caught me on this story was that to get help, Justin had to plead guilty to a higher charge of manslaughter, because that would allow the judge to put him in a treatment program as part of his probation after his prison sentence. And he wants to get sober. He hates being an addict. I thought that was really kind of an indictment of where we are in terms of treatment in this country.
What I thought was fascinating about the story was that you were able to sort of look at DJ's diary. You were able to look at the text messages which had been sent by various people involved in the story, and really tell this DJ struggles as well with the drugs. And sort of he seemed to know that this was swallowing him alive, right?
Yeah, and that's the heartbreaking thing about this case and so many others, is the people who are addicted to these drugs, most of them don't want to be addicted anymore, and they struggle with it, and they know the chances of relapsing are so high, and it's torture for them. And we had this situation where literally, as his best friend Justin is bringing him the drug that kills him, his mother and his girlfriend are texting him because they're worried about him. And they don't want him hanging around with Justin. And they're doing everything they can to try and save this kid, and they can't do it, including setting him up to be arrested, because they figured, at least in jail, his ability to get drugs would be less. I'm not saying it's impossible. So it's just this dramatic situation where they're desperate and there's nothing they can do.
Also in Ohio, there's a town called East Liverpool. In East Liverpool, a couple weeks back, the police department released a photo which was terrifying. It showed, as you know, a young child strapped into a car seat in the back seat, and in the front were two adults who were passed out after overdosing on drugs. And it really ignited a national conversation about, should we be releasing photos of people when they overdose. And this has come up subsequently a couple times since then, including an article in the New York Times about sort of children being present in overdoses. Tell us, you know, why that story got so much attention and captured the national spotlight.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the fact that the police intentionally released that photo. You know, so they made a deliberate, conscious decision to put that photo out. And that was very controversial because a lot of people felt like that further stigmatized drug users, and that's not going to help us solve this problem that we have. But to me, the picture is it produces such a visceral reaction. You have two adults who are completely passed out, almost lifeless, in the front of the car. And in the back seat, you have a four-year-old boy with his dinosaur T-shirt strapped into his car seat with this look like, you know, this is not the first time he's seen this, and he's not quite sure what to do. I just think it hit a nerve because it was so real. And I think also for people, it brought home the fact that this problem that we have with opioids doesn't just impact the people that use it. It impacts everybody around them, and even beyond that.
No, I think you're right. I think when you tweeted the photo out, I think I responded and said, you know, please tell me this is not true, because as a parent, just to see that photo, it was really disturbing, and one where you just are hoping against all hope that, you know, the idea of a child being in the car while this is going on is really a painful thing to think about.
And Charlie, you know, just 2 weeks after that, there was a video released in Massachusetts here, up in Lawrence, of a mother passed out in the supermarket aisle as her toddler, who's in pajamas, desperately tries to wake her. I mean, so we're seeing more and more of these. And, you know, there's a debate about whether or not it's helpful in terms of addressing this problem, but boy, for people who are naive about this or who don't think it affects their community, these videos and these photographs are bringing home sort of a different point.
So one additional question on fentanyl before we move on to a different topic, and that is, I'm an investigative reporter, you're an investigative reporter. What is the wrongdoing here? Who is falling down on the job here? And what needs to be fixed as far as the problem that is repeating itself across the country?
Well, look, here's the problem. You know, for starters, we've done, as a country, and, you know, this starts with the U.S. government, with Customs and Border Patrol and the DEA, we've done a poor job of eliminating the source of the drug, which is primarily China. Now, some of that's out of our control, of course, but it hasn't been as much of a priority as it should be. But in fairness, the problem is so difficult to solve because we have multiple laboratories in China and some other countries in Asia that are sending this product to, you know, criminal syndicates in Canada, to Mexican cartels. And so then there's numerous people with laboratories now that can translate this drug into pill form or put it into heroin. And it's so multifaceted, and there's so many organizations doing it that it's almost like whack-a-mole. 2007, we had a similar outbreak of fentanyl overdoses, similar in as not the same number, but there was a spike. Well, it was one lab in Mexico that was producing it. And the DEA and the Mexican government uncovered it. They shut the lab down. The problem went away. That's not going to happen this time.
You know, one of the things that, in addition to covering the current state of the epidemic, STAT has done is sort of also look back historically at what got this started and looking at the origins of the narcotic painkiller trend and the explosion in the sales and marketing of that drug. And part of that has involved filing motions in court to unseal records that were created and filed in court more than a decade ago by the makers of some of these drugs. So tell us what that, you know, phase of the reporting has been about.
I think for us, learning about where we are today in terms of this crisis involves figuring out how we got here. And one of the things that struck me as I started looking into this is the fact that, just to name one company in particular, although there are others, but Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, was sued thousands of times. They settled with nearly every state in the country over charges of improper marketing and selling of this drug. They paid a $600 million-plus fine with the federal government. But what they also did, and very successfully, was keep all of the records and documentation related to those cases sealed and off limits and ultimately destroyed for the most part. We thought it was important to see, well, exactly what were they doing, and can we get some of these records unsealed so that we know and we can learn from it? And that's what we've been doing, and we've had some success. We sued in Kentucky to unseal records there, and one of the more important documents there is the first and only instance we know of where a member of the Sackler family that owns Purdue Pharma was deposed under oath. And we won that case at the state level, but Purdue is appealing. And then similarly, we went to West Virginia, and a judge there unsealed records related to Abbott Laboratories' marketing of OxyContin. They were a partner of Purdue. And we've learned, I think, from these records how aggressively these drugs were marketed and how misleading the marketing was.
So it's interesting because when I think of OxyContin, you know, my first thought is Purdue, because Purdue's name is so associated with OxyContin as sort of the predominant maker of it and currently the company that markets it. But indeed, Abbott played a key role in marketing the drug back in the 90s and 2000s as well, right? It's just not one that we hear about.
You know, you have to keep that in mind that back when OxyContin first came on the market, Purdue Pharma was a relatively small company. It was a private company based in Connecticut, and they needed the heft and the assistance of a big pharma company that knew how to market drugs, and Abbott was a company like that. So Abbott doubled their sales force for OxyContin and also provided a lot of strategic and marketing advice to Purdue and was well paid for it. I mean, the commissions to Abbott, we were able to figure out from court records, are close to $500 million for their role in the early years of promoting this drug. And it's one that's, their role is just largely escaped any attention.
No, I love the introductory anecdote that you use in the story about the doctor who wouldn't meet with the Abbott sales rep. I'm hoping you could tell that to us.
Yeah, and when I was sitting in West Virginia going through these records, I had to look at that one three or four times because I couldn't quite believe it. This was a case where two different reps from Abbott were calling on the same surgeon, and they were going there every week to see him. And they wanted him to start prescribing OxyContin for post-operative pain for his patients, and he was somebody who was not doing that. And they would bring him lunch for him and his staff, and they'd go and see him. And finally, they said to the staff people, why won't he give us any time? Why won't he listen to us? And they said, well, he doesn't like the lunches you're bringing, but he really has an affinity for junk food. So the next week, they filled up a big sheet cake with donuts and snack cakes and literally spelled out OxyContin. And they brought it to the office. The doctor loved it. He listened to their sales pitch, and they went back every week, and every week they asked him to switch over three patients to OxyContin.
But bringing donuts to doctors was only one element of Abbott's marketing. Another one that I was sort of struck by was the Dine and Dash. So what is Dine and Dash?
I was struck by that as well. So Dine and Dash was a program where the sales representative would say to the doctor, you know, what's your favorite takeout restaurant? And the physician would tell them, and they would make an arrangement where the sales rep would meet the doctor at that takeout restaurant and pay for whatever takeout he wanted. So, you know, picking up dinner for the family on the way home, I'll meet you there and take care of it. And just that few minutes when they're waiting for the rep to pay for the order and for the doctor to pay it was an opportunity to pitch OxyContin. And they did the same thing in bookstores. They would meet doctors at bookstores, pay for their book order, and use that opportunity to sell the drug.
This is not just a historical artifact, right? That Abbott, it seemed, had created what they called the Royal Court of OxyContin and the Kingdom of Abbott Pain Management, and everything was sort of funneled through there. But the head guy, the King of Pain, a guy named Jerry Eichhorn, right?
Correct.
It's not as if he's long retired. What's he doing today?
Well, Abbott Laboratories a couple of years ago spun off their pharmaceutical business into a new company called AbbVie. And Mr. Eichhorn is now the national sales director of AbbVie, which is a big job at a large pharmaceutical company. And some of the other people that were part of that royal court of OxyContin have gone on to big positions at other companies. So I agree with you. I do think it's relevant. I was also struck by the tone of the memos to the sales staff and how this was pursued and projected as a crusade. You know, the language was just, you know, we're talking about a very powerful controlled substance here that, you know, needs to be used carefully. And the tone that they use to sell it and the incentives for the sales staff just seems completely out of whack with the product involved.
Now, do you think that the pharmaceutical industry, and particularly the selling of pain drugs, has changed since that time?
Yes and no. I think some companies have changed. Others have not, and we're actually working on some stories related to that exact question.
Well, good. We'll look forward to those. So I know that journalists are notoriously bad prognosticators and hesitate to get into that, but do you think that we've seen this epidemic peak? Are we now on the ebb of this, or are we still looking at sort of the worst days ahead of us?
I'll tell you what people that are on the front line of this tell me, and that is it's not peaked yet, that we still have a ways to go before we see the top of the peak, if you will. And the largest reason for that is fentanyl. You know, the supply chain is alive and thriving. It's so profitable that, you know, drug dealers of every stripe are getting involved in the trafficking of it. And, you know, the people that deal with this think it's going to be a little while before we get a handle on it.
I have to tell you, David, that is a scary, scary prospect. I really appreciate your joining the podcast today and sharing information about your story. And for those who are interested in reading your stories and seeing your subsequent coverage, it's statnews.com. So thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for the interest, and I enjoyed talking with you.
And thanks for listening to the ProPublica podcast. We hope you'll tune in next week.